Good morning, everyone. My name is Paul Choi. I'm one of the pastors here at Village. It's good to see you all this morning. What an exciting day today, because we are commissioning the Clamton team, and we will be receiving the returning Lebanon team this afternoon. So what an exciting day, and we all be commissioned to our daily life after this service. So please let me begin with one question to ponder this morning. When you think of God, when you think of God based on your own experience and understanding, what kinds of description about Him pop up in your memory? When you think of God based on your own experience, what image or what kinds of description about Him pop up in your memory? What is going to be the single description for you to describe God based on your own experience? Almighty and powerful, provider, omnipotent, omniscient, tender and kind, compassionate, righteous and just, servant king, the humility, slow to anger, redeemer, shepherd. All of them must be indeed true descriptions about Him, and most of us do have some stories to tell to support why we think and believe so, for we know that He is alive. If we were to ask the same question to one of the disciples of Jesus, we know for sure that Apostle John would describe God with this one word, as he devoted a whole letter to describe this character of God. What is the word? God is love. 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 Do you agree with John's testimony? God is love. How do you read the claim? How do you understand the statement that God is love? Is this a good news? Or is this a claim that infuriates us? Make us angry and furious. What about those political dictators who executed a bloody massacre resulting in deaths of millions of lives? Is God love for them also? The apostle also said, because God is love, we also ought to love one another. Are we to love and embrace those killers? Those evildoers, is this a good news or something that makes us furious? What about those who persecute us, those unjust doers in our workplaces, in our businesses, in our daily life conversation where people make gossips against us, direct causes of our sufferings? What if God is love and He also loves them so much, pouring out His grace and abundant blessings upon them? Is the statement that God is love still a good news? And are we thankful for the fact? Or does that drive us crazy and make our blood boil? What about those unexplainable hardships that we had to have come through in our past, the experience of loss, false accusations, failures, disappointments, betrayers, and yet God was still silent, inactive. God is love? Is this a good news, an acceptable claim? Is God love? Especially in times of suffering, when uncontrollable, unbearable pains are pressing us, is God still love? First of all, we must make a distinction between innocent suffering and consequential suffering. Not all sufferings are the same in terms of their nature. There are sufferings that come as a consequence of our sins. We cannot just jump off a cliff and blame God for the injuries. If we blamed God for that, it's actually God who is the innocent sufferer in this case. He must be saying, haven't I been saying to you, don't jump? What I want to question about is not that kind of suffering this morning, but innocent, righteous ones. Those sufferings that were just thrown to us, regardless of our choices and capacities. Those that we cannot make sense about at all. Those about which we have actually given up finding answers and reasons. Oh, we have so many of those, if you bother to be honest. In times of suffering, despite the sufferings, is God still love? You might remember a person whose name is Job in the Old Testament, who must be asking a similar question. A man of perfect integrity who feared God and turned away from evil. Nevertheless, this man experiences a series of extreme sufferings. He was not just pure in his heart with perfect integrity, but was also a purifier for the people around him. See, verse 5 of the chapter describes that Job's regular practice to offer burnt offerings for all of his children. For he thought, it states, perhaps my children have sinned, having cursed God in their hearts. This was Job's regular practice. A purifier, an intercessor, a man who sincerely worships and prays. And God is so proud of this person, having described him as a man of perfect integrity. And he even says to Satan, God even says to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? No one else on earth is like him. But even to a man like this, sufferings attack. It seems that sufferings do not discriminate. Even God-fearing Christians can suffer from cancers, dementia, accidents, tragedies, loss, betrayers, failures, addictions, depression, anxiety. Confused we may be, that is the reality. God-fearing Christians will also someday die. Death will not pass over us. We will die at the end of our lives, but we also die multiple times during the life. Reading from Job 1, one day when Job's sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, a messenger came to Job and reported, while the oxen were plowing and the donkeys grazing nearby, the Sabians swooped down and took them away. They struck down the servants with the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. He was still speaking when another messenger came and reported. A lightning storm struck from heaven. It burned up the sheep and the servant and devoured them. And I alone have escaped to tell you. That messenger was still speaking when yet another came and reported. The Chaldeans formed three bands, made a raid on the camels, and took them away. They struck down the servants with the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. He was still speaking when another messenger came and reported, and this time, your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. Suddenly, a powerful wind swept in from the desert and struck the four corners of the house. It collapsed on the young people so that they died, and I alone have escaped to tell you. If you were him, what did you do in a moment like this? Verse 20. Can we read this verse together? Then Job stood up, tore his robe, and shaved his head. He fell to the ground and worshipped, saying, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will leave this life. The Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Praise the name of Yahweh. Throughout all this, Job did not sin or blame God for anything. What an extraordinary response. Isn't this a rare? What messages do you get from this story and this response? Is this story forcing us a message that we should be worshiping God no matter what sufferings may come unto us? Look at Job. What an example to follow. You all should be like this man. Is this the implication? If not, is the author of the story trying to diminish the heaviness of our current sufferings by asking us to compare them to Job's sufferings? Look at Job. What you are experiencing is nothing compared to Job. There are numerous people who are in more severe cases. Therefore, be encouraged. Is this the implication? What do you think is the central message of this story and the book? This 42 chapters long book, which is full of conversations between Job and his four friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, Zophar, and Elihu. What are these long conversations all about? Some people say that the whole story is indeed about God's sovereignty, trying to tell us about how sovereign He is beyond our understanding. And some say that it's all about the problem of suffering, trying to tackle the profound philosophical question. In other words, a discussion on theodicy, why a good God permits the manifestation of evil. All of these are surely important messages of the story. But I think what is often forgotten is the fact that the book is a wisdom-type writing, wisdom writing in its nature. Alongside other wisdom writings in the Bible, such as Proverbs or Ecclesiastes, the story of Job is asking the question, what is wisdom? What is wisdom? What is a wise living? Where is wisdom? How can we be wise, especially in times of sufferings and despair? When we read the speeches by Job's friends, those four friends, most of them seem to make very good sense. And sometimes they are theologically very sound. We are often drawn to agree with their claims. Meaning, all of the characters are claiming that they know the answers and have the wisdom to navigate this miserable life. What is wisdom? That is the penetrating question throughout the story of the book. How do we know about this? Let us do some technical Bible study for a couple of minutes. We could know that this is the penetrating question of the book by being sensitive to its literary structure and characteristics. Because the story of Job is being narrated as a poetic writing, wisdom writing, being composed of prose, poems, and dialogues. And it displays a full poetic and literary expressions, just like any ancient wisdom writings. For any writings, back then and even now, there are certain formats or literary techniques that we employ in order to express or emphasize the writer's original messages and intents, right? For example, what is a good writing? A good writing in today's culture typically has a good introduction and sound body and a clear conclusion. Intro, body, conclusion. This is one of the agreed forms of good writings in today's culture, right? No good writer shuffles the flow, starting with conclusion and ending with a body or introduction. Also, there are certain forms in our resumes and cover letters. You didn't write a resume in a form of a diary or a fictional novel. You probably want to write a resume which highlights the strengths you have by the means of the design of the page, order and flow, or even the size and color of the font. These are no tricks, but commonly shared and agreed ways of writing in our culture. It's a communication method, a custom. And likewise, we should not ignore the literary nature and characteristics of the Bible either. Divine message given through the human hands. And the scripture was given in a particular culture and history, and we need to be mindful of that. In Jewish literatures, when authors want to emphasize something, it is their custom that they use a chiastic structure. That is, a use of a symmetrical patterns to emphasize what's at the center. I think the best way to explain this technique is this picture. A hamburger. You see, this burger is very beautifully structured. A chiastically structured hamburger. A bun at the top and also at the bottom. And a closer to the center is the cheese up and down. And a more closer to the center is the lettuce and tomatoes. And at the very center is a patty. Every element is important, but what defines this burger is the patty. If it's a beef, then it's a beef burger. If chicken, it's a chicken burger. This is a chiastic structure, a Jewish literary technique to emphasize what's at the center. So look at this passage from Luke chapter 4. This passage is called the Nazareth Manifesto, because it is a scene in which Jesus proclaims his messianic identity and mission at a synagogue. And this quote from Isaiah 61 passage is very important for the evangelist to explain about the mission of Jesus. And this is how the story emphasizes the passage, a chiastic structure. The story starts by saying that Jesus stood up to read. And the story ends by saying he sat down. Do they not match standing up, sitting down? The scroll of the prophet Isaiah was handed to him, and later he gave back, handing in and giving back. Unrolling it, Jesus found the place where it is written, and later he rolled up the scroll, unrolling and rolling. Why this way? It is to emphasize what's in the center. This is what the Messiah is going to do. Again, this is not a trick, but a commonly shared and easily recognizable literary form to deliver the emphasis in the Jewish literary culture. And likewise, some have identified that the whole book of Job is written in a chiastic structure. And this is not a surprise for a wisdom writing like this with a poetic, literary nature. Don't worry about the details. Let's just see the flow. Job's life story is narrated in the beginning chapters, and the counter-narrative reappears at the very end of the book. Just as his righteousness was declared in chapter 1, it is redeclared, after all, in chapter 42. Stories of his sons and daughters and all the flocks reappear at the end, and the numbers also match between them. And chapter 3 is Job's speech, saying that there are so many tragic mistakes in the world, and there are things that should never happen. He uses vocabularies like birth, womb, offspring, light, darkness, and so forth. And in chapter 38 through 42, it is God's counter speech saying that there are no mistakes in the world and that everything is under God's control. And he uses the same vocabularies like birth, womb, offspring, light, darkness. 60 nouns from chapter 3 are repeated. 120 times in the counter speech by God. Closer towards the center are conversations between Job and his friends. The upper part is a conversation with three of his friends who showed up from the beginning. And the lower part is a new conversation with a new young friend, Elihu, who suddenly joins the conversation, a self-acting sage. And in the very middle, at the very center of those messy, blaming dialogues, there is chapter 28. And the whole chapter is a poem. It's a completely new poetic type of writing invading into the dialogues. A poem, a song, a cry, or a lament. A poetic song that prophetically breaks the messiness. A confession of a pure heart that brings everything towards the essence. Are you with me now? What a symphony it is. Beautifully written to deliver the divine message. What does this flow tell us, considering the literary characteristics of this story, in order to grasp what the main idea of the whole story of Job is? We'd better check what's in the center. Chapter 28. Because that defines the whole story. And we soon find that chapter 28 is a wisdom poem. What is wisdom? What is understanding? How can we get it in the midst of all these unexplainable sufferings and life situations? What is wisdom? What is a wise way out? How should Job live now? Can he ever overcome the sufferings? What is the will of God if there's such thing? These are the poet's question. So the poem is divided into three strophes with the repeated refrain in verse 12 and verse 20 of the chapter. Verse 12, where can wisdom be found and where is understanding located? And verse 20 is a repetition of the same refrain. Where then does wisdom come from and where is understanding located? A cute question for the poem and also ultimately the key question for the whole story of Job. Where is wisdom? And the first section of the poem, verses 1 through 11, asserts that human research has not discovered wisdom, meaning we don't know the way to wisdom. Look at verse 1. Surely there is a mine for silver and a place where gold is refined. But where is wisdom? Where can we find it? The poet cries because he does not know where it can be found or how he could be wise. And the second section of the poem, verses 13 through 19, states that human wealth cannot purchase wisdom. Meaning, even if we know what a wise living is like, are we able to live it out? Look at verse 19. Topaz from Cush cannot compare with it, and it cannot be valued in pure gold. Meaning, even if we find where the wisdom is, can we afford it? Stating that the wisdom is the highest value in life and the world, and we don't have a vessel to contain it. And the final section of the poem, verses 21 through 28, is the conclusion of the chapter, and therefore the conclusion of the whole story of Job. And look at verse 28. He said to mankind, look, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to turn from evil is understanding. What is it saying? It is the same conclusion alongside other wisdom writings in the Proverbs or the Ecclesiastes. What is wisdom? It is the fear of the Lord. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. At every moment of life, at every step of move, in fear of the Lord. Should I go right or left? Should I move forward or step backward? Do this in the fear of the Lord, says the book of Job. Oh, well, that sounds nice. But what do we actually mean by the fear of the Lord? The poet does not leave us there, asking us to come up with our own understanding of the phrase, but he guides us from the abstract to the more concrete understanding of the phrase. There are different aspects that each biblical wisdom writers emphasize when they say the fear of the Lord, and the aspect of the phrase that the writer of Job is emphasizing can be found in verse 23. Shall we also read this verse together? But God understands the way to wisdom, and he knows its location. You see, every expression is important and intended for poets, right? And this verse is very poetic expression to make an important theological claim. Based on verse 23, please let me ask you, so where is wisdom? Where is wisdom based on verse 23? In the mountains? In the valleys? We still don't know. All we know is that he knows the way to it. Then what do we need to do? Should we give up finding wisdom? No. What do we need to do? Just walk with him. Just walk with him. You haven't grasped the wisdom yet. You don't have all the explanations for your sufferings. Still, we may think that there are so many mistakes in the world. But yet, just be patient and follow him. Just wait to see what he has got. Don't go astray, but keep following him, for he surely knows the way to wisdom and understanding. What is the fear of the Lord? Companionship. Companionship is a call to walk together. It's a call to follow. Not because we understand everything now, but because we choose to trust him. Faith is not a confident triumphalism, but a choice to trust once again, a choice to trust once again in the midst of hesitations. Remember the famous verse from Job 23. He knows the way I have taken. He knows the way of my life and the way to wisdom. When he has tested me, I will come forth as a pure gold. What is the outcome of this process in time? To make Job a stronger and a self-powerful person? No, a pure gold. A pure gold is made not by adding other elements, but by getting rid of unnecessary elements from the stone. That's the purification process. Getting rid of our trust to false gods, money god, happiness god, family god, things that we have held on to. That is what happens on the way, on our walk together with God towards wisdom. And when Job realized this, he seems to be very much relieved. So in the final chapter of the book, he states, "Now my eyes have seen you." If you see chapter 42, "Now my eyes have seen you, and I take back my words, and I repent in dust and ashes. meaning now I am relieved and in peace. What is interesting is that Job still does not know what happened behind the scene of chapter 1, you know, the divine conversation between God and the Satan. God does not give him a debriefing of what happened and why that had to happen. Job still does not know the reasons for his trials and sufferings. We, the audience, know, but Job doesn't. But yet, he states that he is now relieved and he is now in peace. Why is that? It's not because everything is now explained, understandable, and makes sense. Some things may probably never be explained to us. Do you think Job will be happier if he heard about what happened in chapter 1? Or would that make him more frustrated? We will probably not be at peace even if we understood the logics and reasons for everything for the world. Who would fully understand the deep inside the heart of God? But we will be at peace if we sense the presence of God in our life. Just as what Job says, "Now my eyes have seen you, and that's enough." And that's enough. What is wisdom? It's a companionship with the living God. It's a choice to trust once again that God is alive and present, and that he works even in the midst of sufferings, and that he makes beautiful things even out of dust. It's a choice to see God even when he seems so invisible. You see, there are times when God seems so invisible. There are times when God is so silent. But suppose that you're a commander, a man in charge, and that there is a very dangerous and risky mission to accomplish, and you are to send a soldier for the mission. And that happens to be your son. The son stands right in front of you, afraid, but committed, now ready to be commissioned. He's standing in front of you, and he is looking at your eyes. What would you say to him? Perhaps nothing. Not because you don't care, but because there's so much to say. Perhaps you must be saying so much things with your eyes, but perhaps nothing from your mouth. Isn't this what happened at the cross? The harsh silence of the Father, neglection of the Father. It's not because he did not care, but because he loved the Son. When sufferings come and God seems to be invisible and silent, it's not because he has discarded your life. The silence is an evidence that you are his sons and daughters, his beloved. His eyes are not turned away from you at all, but perhaps his eyes must be brimming over with tears. Run away from the self-accusations that perhaps because of my past sins, I am suffering with these punishments. Do not listen to the voice of Job's friends, for one day they will be ashamed of having blamed so. In the midst of sufferings, where can wisdom be found? The fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, says the sage. The fear of the Lord is a companionship with the living God. It is another courageous choice to trust him in the midst of fears and agitations. It seems to me that a genuine faith always contains fears and ambiguities alongside. Perhaps one might think if a person has a genuine faith, he will have no fear at all. But is that true in your case? Have you ever truly got rid of all the fears because you have a full faith in God? Perhaps it is my lack of faith, but for me, faith and fear usually stay together. For me, fear is not the opposite to faith, but a friend of faith. Faith is not a self-suggestion nor a self-reinforcement. Faith is not a confident triumphalism, but faith is another courageous choice to remain still, even in the midst of fears and agitations, until we see God in the situation. Faith is not a mystical power to change the reality, but it becomes our eyes to see meanings out of the unchanging messiness. We were surprised when we read about Job's initial response after hearing the tragic news from multiple messengers in chapter 1. Job stood up, tore his robe, and shaved his head. He fell to the ground and worshiped God. But was this moment the climax of his faith? Is this a model of our faith in our sufferings? Yes, he had a genuine faith, but what about the next chapters, chapter 2, chapter 3, and all his doubtful conversation with his friends later? What about the moment he cursed on his birth in chapter 3? Do these invalidate his faith? Do these cancel off the validity of his worship in chapter 1? No. I believe the climax of his faith was not in chapter 1, but in chapter 42. Those fears, doubts, and ambiguities throughout those chapters do not invalidate his faith. His faith is at its climax, not because he dismisses all the fears and doubts, but because he continues to choose to take another step of trusting the Lord over the existing fears and doubts. That is wisdom. The Job of chapter 42 is our model of faith. Just like Jesus on the Garden of Gethsemane, "Father, if it is possible, may this cup be taken from me. Yet not as I will, but as you will." Was Jesus faithless when he asked for the removal of the cup? No. That is the nature of faith. It is about our continuing choice, renewal of our choice to remain with Jesus and walk with this loving Jesus. When the audience of a story finishes the final chapter of a book, they sometimes come up with impertinent imaginations of what ifs. What if the ending was different? What if the character acted differently? Now we've finished reading the story of Job, and we now realize that there were potentially some different scenarios to end the story. What if Job was so much disappointed at God, denied him, cursed him, and completely left his faith? What would have been an alternative ending in that scenario? The alternative ending to that scenario would be
that God kneels down before the Satan and says to him, "You are right, and I was wrong. Job does not fear me for nothing." The Creator God, the King of the universe, kneeling down before the Satan because he was wrong. Yes, Job trusted the Lord, but there was an even more extreme trust. This trust from God about Job, that Job will not fail, but trust and love God nevertheless. God had this trust for Job, and so does he for you. It is not our own faith that saves us, but his steadfast love and trust for us that will take us to our faith in him. Therefore, brothers and sisters, what is your choice today? Would you still say, "God is love"? Would you choose your own wisdom to explain the present sufferings, or choose to remain silent in trust of the Lord? In other words, would you fear God for nothing?